of announcements.
For freight or passage, apply on board.
Think of going on board a coppered and copper-fastened brig and taking passage for Bremen. And who could be going to Bremen? No one but foreigners, doubtless. Men of dark complexions and jet-black whiskers who talked French.
Coenties slip.
Plenty more brigs and any quantity of ships must be lying there. Coenties slip must be somewhere near ranges of grim-looking warehouses with rusty iron doors and shutters and tiled roofs and old anchors and chain cable piled on the walk. Old-fashioned coffee houses also much abound in that neighborhood, with sunburnt sea captains going in and out, smoking cigars and talking about Havana, London, and Calcutta. All these my imaginations were wonderfully assisted by certain shadowy reminiscences of wharves and warehouses and shipping with which a residence in a seaport during early childhood had supplied me. Particularly, I remembered standing with my father on the wharf when a large ship was getting underway and rounding the head of the pier. I remembered the yo heave ho of the sailors as they just showed their woolen caps above the high bulwarks. I remembered how I thought of their crossing the great ocean, and that that very ship and those very sailors so near to me then would after a time be actually in Europe. Added to these reminiscences, my father, now dead, had several times crossed the Atlantic on business affairs, for he had been an importer in Broad Street. And of winter evenings in New York, by the well-remembered sea coal fire in old Greenwich Street, he used to tell my brother and me of the monstrous waves at sea, mountain high, of the masts bending like twigs, and all about Havre and Liverpool, and about going up into the ball of St. Paul's in London. Indeed, during my early life, most of my thoughts of the sea were connected with the land, but with fine old lands, full of mossy cathedrals and churches, and long, narrow, crooked streets without sidewalks, and lined with strange houses. And especially, I tried hard to think how such places must look of rainy days and Saturday afternoons, and whether indeed they did have rainy days and Saturdays there, just as we did here, and whether the boys went to school there and studied geography and wore their shirt collars turned over and tied with a black ribbon, and whether their papas allowed them to wear boots instead of shoes, which I so much disliked, for boots looked so manly. As I grew older, my thoughts took a larger flight, and I frequently fell into long reveries about distant voyages and travels, and thought how fine it would be to be able to talk about remote and barbarous countries, with what reverence and wonder people would regard me if I had just returned from the coast of Africa or New Zealand, how dark and romantic my sunburnt cheeks would look, how I would bring home with me foreign clothes of a rich fabric and princely make and wear them up and down the streets, and how grocers' boys would turn back their heads to look at me as I went by. For I very well remembered staring at a man myself, who was pointed out to me by my aunt one Sunday in church as the person who had been in Stony Arabia and passed through strange adventures there, all of which with my own eyes I had read in the book which he wrote, an arid-looking book in a pale yellow cover.
"See what big eyes he has," whispered my aunt. "They got so big because when he was almost dead with famishing in the desert, he all at once caught sight of a date tree with the ripe fruit hanging on it."
Upon this, I stared at him till I thought his eyes were really of an uncommon size and stuck out from his head like those of a lobster. I am sure my own eyes must have magnified as I stared. When church was out, I wanted my aunt to take me along and follow the traveler home, but she said the constable